like to thank the societies and Al particularly for inviting us to give his talk. Thank you. This was actually a very nice trip. I've been here a week, so I won't be able to use the excuse that it's only 7 a.m., although I would normally be away. This is about the first time I've ever come to the US and got off the plane from LA and walked out the door. I almost always have to go to Mexico or Des Moines or Calais, you know, somewhere else, and it was such a relief. Even though it was a 12-hour flight, it was city to city, get out. So it's very pleasant. Okay, my co-authors are Eric Van Oostrum from UQ, Karine Chenu from Didi, Greg McLean from Didi, and Graham Hammer from UQ. And Didi is a new name of the Prime Industries Group. So I've probably changed the title a little bit. It's about more about to develop. I think for people who know the kind of work that I've done quite a lot in the past, you'll be relieved to know I'm going to have even less genetics in my talk than Ken did. So that'll be a bit of a change, because normally I have all the genetics and people come up to me afterwards and say, what the hell was that about? So what I want to do is talk more about the physiological structure of our crop models and how we've designed them for use in molecular plant breeding. And the main limitation is in predicting phenotype based on genotype, as Ken and other people have already talked about. So I want to go through the modelling framework that we use, some of the principles that we use to put rigour into that framework so that we, I guess, think it's robust enough to do what we want it to do. And I was trying to think about a good excuse to put the two examples in that I had, and I thought, well, it's actually modelling in two directions. We're sort of, in one of them, we're phenotype to gene, and the other one, we're gene to phenotype. But I guess I was thinking maybe if I could go both directions, it was evidence I had a good model, but I'll let you guys judge that at the end. It might just turn out to be really confusing. I'm going to give you a short overview of the redesign template in AppSim. So this has only been published just recently in JXBot 2010. And I don't want to go through all of the detail, but basically we've got environment information here. These are the parameters that we would set. These are more or less genotypic parameters, radiation use efficiency, extinction coefficient, root elongation rate, KL, which is to do with water uptake, transpiration efficiency, leaf initiation rate, leaf appearance rate. So they're fairly genetically stable, most of them, but the main ones that get adjusted are the ones related to phenology. This shows you some of the dynamics of other components of the model, and I don't want to go through all the detail. What I want to emphasize is that the new template we've been working on has a connection to a nitrogen dynamics model that I'll show you in the next slide, and that connection comes through SLN, Senesce leaf area, and grain end. So I'll show you in the next slide how they fit into the nitrogen dynamics. And the nitrogen dynamics basically accepts these two as inputs, the carbon partitioning and grain number. So you can see here's the carbon partitioning and grain number coming in. And here are these bits of information from the nitrogen model that are fed back to the crop growth dynamics. So I think the important thing I want to highlight is that there's a very simple set of nitrogen parameters. Minimum stem nitrogen, we had to put that in there because we needed some kind of structural nitrogen in the stem. The rest of these parameters, critical SLN, that's for growing new leaf. That's an SLN that you need to grow the new leaf. Nitrogen demand per grain when we're setting up how much the rate of filling is going to be, and a maximum N uptake rate. So these things are not necessarily genetic parameters. In fact, we don't change them at all. But what we're trying to do is show that this new model can do the job without changing these things at all, because it does capture the dynamics. So I'll try to illustrate that in the next example. So the main driver for this was that we wanted to get away from the types of nitrogen models where you supply all of the, you know, minimum, maximum, critical, over time type nitrogen parameters and make it a lot more dynamic. So this is all reported in this paper. So I didn't feel too guilty about reporting it because it's reasonably new. And I'm in the US, so maybe someone hadn't read it. So this work was all done, a series of experiments. We've done 40 or 50 of these. But a lot of the development was done when we realized that these single dwarf sorghums, which are 2.5 to 3 meters high, produce a lot more biomass and yield than our triple dwarfs, which is the conventional material that we work on. And it turns out that they have a higher radiation use efficiency. Now, I'd love to be able to tell you that we know exactly why that is, but we don't. They have the same extinction coefficient. Barbara George Jugley has just finished her PhD on this. Someone in this room may have read it, I'm not sure. But we don't really know what's going on. It could be photosynthetic, right, but we really don't think so. There could certainly be some issue about partitioning to roots, that these tall materials may have less partitioning to roots. But that's probably beside the point for this model, we think. What else we see is that the tall genotypes have decreased partitioning to leaf. So this is node number against the partitioning fraction to leaf. So, you know, these big tall plants, I've had to leave a few figures out, but they basically grow a lot more stem, and they have increased partitioning to stem and less to leaf. And so we have these two lines describing the tall versus the short type. They've also differ a little bit in grain set, but I won't go into that. So when we look at the simulation of this, if we compare under non-limiting conditions the tall and the short type, you can see here for biomass, the maximum biomass of these talls is greater than the short. The grain yield is greater than in the short. We capture the nitrogen dynamics, we capture the leaf area dynamics and the leaf number dynamics. So you can see that these tall materials put on quite a few more leaves, and they're a little bit later flowering, but not very much. Now, when we put them under limited water conditions, this is what a tall plant does for biomass. This is total biomass and grain biomass and stem biomass. You can see under this limited water supply, they end up, that's leaf biomass, ends up with almost no leaf. That's the same for nitrogen, leaf area, and this is the dynamic of the stress. So you can see it was a terminal drought stress. And this is limited nitrogen in a short genotype. So I encourage you to read some more in the about this in the paper. But what we wanted to do and what we achieved was this is the specific leaf nitrogen, and you can see that we're able to model that quite well, the dynamics of the specific leaf nitrogen over the season. So what can we do with this kind of an approach? What we were interested in doing was saying, well, it does seem back here that these talls and shorts may have some difference in nitrogen dynamics, but it's difficult for us to interpret this because they're slightly different phenology and different partitioning coefficients and so on. So we said, well, let's go back to the model and run it again. And this time, we'll assume that the tall and the short cultivars differ only for the parameters related to height growth, which is basically stem node appearance over time, partitioning to stem, and radiation use efficiency. So there's only those three, or there's actually four parameters that differ between these two genotypes. Everything else is the same. And it's run in one of our conventional environments with, well, this is almost non-limiting nitrogen, but it was distributed over the season to give it a good nitrogen supply. And so the consequence of that, so that we can compare these hybrids under equal conditions or equal assumptions, is that we see this tall hybrid producing more biomass, producing more grain. And the question is, how does it do that? The total nitrogen uptake doesn't differ very much. So you can see that those lines are overlapping for total N, and indeed for grain N. The main difference perhaps is in stem N. It's dragging that down, and sorry, you can't see the leaf nitrogen, but the leaf nitrogen's being dragged down faster too. And that's a little bit clearer in the next graph, where what you see, we had exactly the same leaf area profiles on these two cultivars. And what's happened is that because of the grain demand cutting in on both materials at the same time, the tall, because it's got relatively more biomass in stem, it doesn't have as much nitrogen free to deliver to the grain. So you get this dynamic where you get more senescence of leaf, and you also get this reduction in specific leaf nitrogen. So basically, these tall genotypes have to mine their leaf area to be able to achieve this, to do what they do in the field. And in fact, this thing looks a lot more like a maize plant than a sorghum plant, and it does so in its dynamics as well as in its actual appearance, apart from the big orange thing on the top. So, I guess what we were able to do is replace this critical nitrogen concentration approach with an organ demand and supply for nitrogen, and it captures the dynamics really quite well. There are some needs, and we elaborate a bit more on those in the paper. We're still trying to get this grain number prediction tuned up in sorghum. It's pretty good. I mean, it does a good enough job for most of our agronomic research, but trying to push it into genetics, we still need to do a little bit of work on it. One of the things we discussed a bit in the paper is, do we need an architectural model to do what we're doing? Because there's a lot of debate about that. I think there's a talk after mine on architectural modelling. I guess we would argue that we're able to capture most of the controlling principles with the approach we're using with these structural type models. So we don't see the need to model it architecturally just yet. We do see some needs down the track as we're trying to get closer to some of the genetic controls. So what I wanted to do was, I hope I'm about halfway, am I? Is that about halfway? I think so. Pretty close. That's good. Thank you. I like some precision from my modelling colleagues. I thought, well, you can ask questions on both of these, but I'll zip through this one where it gets a bit more genetical. I wanted to explain a different use of the AppSim environment that we've made of it in the last 2 or 3 years, and that was to incorporate some really nice research from François Tardieu's group on understanding leaf elongation at the leaf level and building that into our crop model, because, well, this sort of arose out of a Generation Challenge project, and François more or less challenges to do it, so we thought we'd better try. And we had a very good postdoc, Corinne Chenu, who really helped this happen. So why would we want to do this? Again, you'll be glad to know I'm not going to go off into the breeding world too far, but the main reason we're interested in this is thinking about breeding programs as searches on a gene by trait, by environment, by management landscapes. And every time someone inserts a new letter, we'll put another one in, we promise. but this feeds into a lot of the research, some of which is listed down here, on trying to model entire breeding programs and work out how the dynamics of that works over the time, and interacting breeding programs with crop simulation models. But I'm not going to elaborate that on that today. So the work from Tardieu's team, for people might not be so aware of it, what they did was they really studied leaf elongation rates. So they wired up a whole glasshouse and they measured how fast leaf 7, grows. And they monitored it all the time, and they drought stressed the plants, and they let the VPD go up and down, they let temperature go up and down, and then they did a huge amount of analysis to work out QTL that were associated with the controls of that. The other part that we had to build into the model was an impression of how anthesis silking interval works, which is basically through change in partitioning to the ear. We understand that, I think, well enough to be able to build it into the model. I'm not going to elaborate a lot on that today. So what we want to know is, how does environment interact with these QTL and affect yield. So this is an overview of Mathieu Ramon's work. So what he was studying was looking at leaf elongation rate against temperature. Okay, so this is one genotype. It's got a nice linear response in millimeters per hour of growth. If you adjust that by thermal time, you get a flat line for that genotype. And if you do other genotypes, you'll find that there's a whole series of parallel lines. If you then look at the data that was collected on VPD, so this is as the crop's growing, you'll see there's a slope that is steeper if something has a strong response to high VPD. And there's also another equation related to leaf water potential, which is an effective measure of the soil water potential. So I won't elaborate on how they did it. You can have a look at that. Now, Francois' thing keeps appearing, and people wonder why you've missed him. I've deleted that out of my slide three times, and it keeps coming back. I don't know why. It's a slide I used a few months ago. I apologise, because Francois wasn't here this morning unless... did anyone see him? I don't think he was here. And what they had done is look at these coefficients of A, B and C, and basically they were finding across different experiments that these were quite consistent in their location on the genome. And these are some genotypes differing in these different responses. You can see the differences in slope. So they studied a population, and we took all of the QTL calculations from that population at 11 of these genomic regions. The other thing they found was that the QTLs associated with anthesis silking interval in other experiments were quite highly correlated. So at least a few of these leaf elongation QTL seemed to be also associated with flowering time controls or controls that affect allocation of biomass to the ear. So what did we do with all that? Well, it was pretty simple. In AppSim, all we had to do was put a leaf elongation model inside our maize model. And an ASI model, as I said, I'm not going to elaborate on that one today, but I'll show you what we did to put the leaf elongation in. So the first thing we had to do, which was a bit traumatic at the start, was that we had to simulate daily variation in microenvironments. And we thought this was going to be awfully difficult, and it turns out that it wasn't that hard, and it worked quite well. So we used some old ag forest met work from Colorado. I've forgotten the exact reference now, but we were able to do a reasonably good job of interpolating the daily weather data and recreating these effects of low and high VPD. This is under, the black one's well watered and the red one is water deficit. So this gives you some idea of the effects, and you can see that in a deficit material, the leaf elongation rate would drop off and come back in the middle of the day. And of course we know those are the kinds of things that happen. We had to integrate at the plant level, and while this was goes against the grain a little for the philosophy that we have on how we build our models, we didn't have much choice but to do a better definition of exactly how the pattern of leaf expansion occurs, because you had to get this duration right to make these models work. And so we had to, we had fortunately a lot of really nice field data again from the French group to do this. And these are very robust fits of predicting leaf growth patterns. And that, of course, the result is that the laminar length changes with, that should have different numbers of leaves on there. I think that's leaf 6, 10 and 14 in this case. So we tested that, and you can see that for evaporative demand, you get a change in the profile of leaf length as you go from the bottom of the plant up to the top of the plant. So this is a low VPD plant and this is a high VPD plant. You can see a strong effect in the middle part of the canopy. This is the effect of water deficit, and these are some simulated leaf area index against observed. So we're reasonably happy that we can do an okay job. We didn't have a huge amount of data to validate this, but at least the model seems to not lost any of its previous capability. It's still pretty good at what it was doing before. So now, unfortunately, I have to talk some genetics. I won't do too much of it. First, just to reiterate, I guess, we had APSIM here, the leaf elongation model connected into it. So the genetic information is feeding straight into the LER model, and it's also feeding into APSIM. Now, we don't build any of these parameters inside APSIM. All of the genetic calculations are done outside. They're all done in our genetic simulation tools. And we create those parameters from the populations, and each genotype then gets its new values. And the reason we do it that way is it allows us to use any type of genetic model to explain any parameter. So we can use additive, epistasis, dominance, everything that we want for any part of a parameter. And we can describe a single parameter with any genetic model that any quantitative geneticist can dream up. And that's very important to us because linear models don't always cut it when we're trying to do some of the things we're trying to do. And I think it's something worth thinking about is whether you need to separate these out or not, and what's the easiest way to handle them. It also makes it a lot easier for us to add new ones in without that assumption. Of course, APSIM is taking in weather, soil, and management data and feeding that back to a leaf environment, which affects this model, producing the LAI for APSIM. So, this is actually a really simple diagram. We're talking about 11 QTLs here, and all this does is show you, I've given them names that indicate that they're associated with A, B, or C in the leaf elongation rate diagram. So you can see that that one there only affects the value of A, and some of them affect more than one thing. And the size of them is the size of the QTL effect, and whether they have a positive or negative effect. So it does actually get quite complicated because some of these QTL have positive effects, other ones have negative. So in the same genotype, you can have things cancelling out, and you end up with a median effect on LER. But this is just one way of displaying that. And you can see that four of these QTL are connected to grain effects, or effects on grain growth and ASI. I only wanted to put this one up to sort of point you towards the genetics paper. I haven't got a lot of time to explain it, but what we're able to do for traits like A, B, B, C, and C, A, all this does is this is for the population that Francois' group were working with. This is the distribution of values across their population, and these are the effects on yield, in fact, in a high VPD environment. And the important thing to note is that there are parts of this space which the genetics that they had in their population couldn't explore. So the best genotype you could possibly have would have a high A, a high B, and a low C, and that's in that part of the box. Now, the genetics they have available to them, you can never get there. And that's partly because there's some pleiotropic linkage in some of these traits, or at least we think they are. They're affecting each other, and you can't get there. Now, it may be possible to find genotypes that can get there, but it certainly weren't there in that population. But this is something we can test in experimenting in the future. This is in the genetics paper as well. Simply put, we ran 45 years of simulations, and all you have to do is look at the fact that we got different drought patterns here. This is time of season, so this is a moderate stress, this is a grain filling stress, and this is a terminal stress. And so what we want to do is say, well, if you grew this population in Brazil and all of these environments, what would happen, and which genotypes would be the best? And what would be the QTL that you would detect if you ran experiments on those four environments? And what we find is that if you only think about leaf elongation, you have some environments in which you detect QTL, and some you don't, and some that have different effects. So if we look at ET1, which is this mild stress, okay, just here, if you do a QTL experiment, you'll find that a bunch of these QTL have negative effects on yield, So the first four or five of these have negative effects, and then there's some QTLs that have positive effects on yield. So it's very conditional. And in most environments, there's a small effect. Now, when you take that same population and you put ASI in, and you put the grain growth effects in, then you'll have a much bigger effect on yield, because some of these, as I said earlier, some of these anthesis silking traits are affecting grain number, and that's impacting on the yield. So I guess the way that we've been using this is to say, you may detect, and Francois's group, they did, they had these two QTLs that have similar effects on this temperature response. Once we run them through our model, in some environments, they'll have opposite effects on yield. And so it gives you an idea of the problem of trying to scale up from the type of work they were doing, and then trying to, you know, if you went straight to the field and started selecting for that LER, you'd end up with material that wasn't very good, depending on which of these QTLs you used. So this probably seems a bit of an abrupt conclusion, but I thought I'd better stop. I guess what I was just trying to show here is that we spent a lot of time and a lot of meetings sitting around arguing, usually in nice environments, we hope, trying to work out how to design these models so that they capture these dynamics well. And in the nitrogen work in particular, I'd refer you to the papers that Eric van Oostrum published in was Field Crops, I think, yes, earlier this year. And Eric's really laid out all of those nitrogen models there. So it's well worth having a good look at how we thought that through, because it was very painful and it took us about 10 years to do it, I have to say. We think we can scale up fairly well with these models and start to capture a lot of these interplays that, of course, other people have referred to in this symposium. And I want to talk to you more about the physiological model today, but of course we're taking this a lot further than that in investigation of breeding strategies, and I gave you some references. You can chase that up. I don't know that I succeeded at all in justifying whether I can validate in both directions, gene to phenotype and phenotype to gene. I think it's more a case that when we're trying to design the way that we build these models, we try to think in both directions and try to think about what are the implications if we're going one way or the other. And the main thing we're trying to do is give our models as little information as possible so that they tell us what's going on. I mean, that's the underlying philosophy. And I want to finish with acknowledgements. GRDC and the Generation Challenge Program funded a lot of the work, and GRDC sorghum and GCP, the maize work. And of course, we had some good collaborations with INRA in the maize research. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.